perfect you know, speaker to start this series. Kasia has been with us for about 3 years, you know, quality as
at least
in her fellowship. And she, you know, she exemplified the spirit of PI because she talks to, she has a very broad range of interest and she interacts with a lot of different groups. She's mostly mathematical physics, but quantum theory, quantum gravity. And she did her PhD in 2011 with Fred Hagen on the renewal of algebraic quantum theory. She wrote a book about it in 2016. She's also interested in the geometry of the BV formalism and extending this perturbative algebraic quantum theory to gauge theories. And today, she's going to talk about observables and non-locality in perturbative algebra.
All right, thank you, Laurent, for this very nice introduction, and thanks for the invitation. Most of you know me, but it's great to be here again. Really like the atmosphere of the place. All right, so I want to tell you something about my work, and I will start very basic. So I will first tell you what's algebraic quantum field theory and how nowadays we generalize it. So where is it, this whole thing going? And then I will focus on the framework I have contributed to develop. So perturbative AQFT, first like basic outline, because I assume that not everybody knows about it. And then I want to say about the main thing of the talk, so how non-locality fits into that framework. Okay, so let's start with AQFT. So originally, this was a way to think about quantum field theory. So mathematicians, mathematical physicists developed a framework to study some conceptual problems model independent. So this is algebraic QFT. And it goes back to Hagen-Kassler to the 60s. And the idea is that a model of a quantum field theory is defined by associating to a region of Minkowski spacetime the algebra of observables that can be measured in that region. And for them, this algebra of observables was a unitary system algebra. If you don't know what it is, don't worry, because this is not going to be super relevant. It's just that there is some algebraic structure that you can associate to regions of spacetime. And then if you have a larger region, which encompasses a smaller region, then the requirement they had was that the algebra of the smaller region fits into the algebra of the larger region. So there is some notion of subsystems. Okay, so the structure one gets from this associating of algebraic structure to geometry, one gets a net of sister algebra. So if you read all AQFT books, papers, references, they will talk a lot about nets of sister algebras. Okay, oops, sorry, went too fast. So what's the key idea for me? I grew up in that community, so I took what I wanted, I left what I didn't. What I really appreciate from that whole framework is that this algebra of observables, whatever they are, is constructed independently of the choice of vacuum. So mathematically, this has something to do with the choice of a state on your C-star algebra. So first thing that it allows us to do, so we consider systems where there is no unique vacuum, so we have degenerate vacua, so this is cool. And actually, we can also take this idea and run away with it and go beyond this context of sister algebras or locality whatsoever. But this idea that algebra comes first and Hilbert spaces come later, this has been very important for me, and that's what I want to keep for the framework. Okay, so first thing we give up is the flat spacetime. Okay, the guys started in Minkowski spacetime, but there are more interesting things in life. So if we want to include some effects of general relativity, then we want to work with curved spacetime, obviously. So like Friedman, Robertson, Walker, Schwarzschild, anything really, right? I mean, flat spacetime is really non-physical. So we have to extend this framework a bit. And this extension goes under the name locally covariant quantum field theory. So what is it? So instead of having two regions of Minkowski spacetime that we include in each other, so that was the previous slide, now we associate algebraic structure to the whole class of Lorentzian manifolds. So take M and N, which are Lorentzian manifolds of spacetimes, consider their embeddings. So you have this huge family of spacetimes together with their embeddings. We want these embeddings to preserve some structure, in particular to be isometries. So we put some requirements on those. And those of you who are more mathematically minded recognize that, oh, I'm building a category, right? So these spacetimes are objects, and these embeddings are morphisms of my category. So this is kind of the general language we use. And a model, a QFT model, is given by assigning observables, so algebras, to spacetimes, so like here, and algebra morphisms, like here, to those embeddings. So again, if you're mathematically minded, then you realize that this is a functor. So in this modern take on a QFT, we want to think about a QFT model as a functor. This is just to put things in a bit of a context. I will not refer too much to very technical category theory language, but just if you like functors, then you might think of all I'm trying to do for the rest of the talk as constructing certain functors to satisfy my favorite properties. All right, so now perturbative AQFT. So why do we care? Well, first of all, we care about physics. We care about models. The axioms are great, are beautiful. I love axioms. But of course, if we want to do some physics, then we want to be able to build models which are physically relevant, or any models at all which are non-trivial. So it turns out that in AQFT, as such, it's very hard to build models, and we don't have a fully rigorous four-dimensional interacting models. This is very embarrassing. So in order to describe interesting theories like quantum electrodynamics or the standard model, we need to use perturbative methods like everybody else, okay? So in quantum field theory, people use perturbative methods all the time. They get results, they get predictions. So why not do it in this AQFT business, right? So this is what a bunch of people tried, me included. So we developed a framework called perturbative AQFT. I will abbreviate it PAQFT.
Question.
Oh, sorry. Yes.
Yes. Very naive.
Yeah, sure.
It seems that what's missing to define interacting quantum field theory is the notion of regulation or renormalization.
Mm-hmm.
Can you add those to the data of the functor?
Yes. I mean, not really to the functor, but more like, so what I'm going to say in the rest of the talk, I will give you an idea how to construct what I will call non-renormalized functor and how to renormalize it. So the idea of regulation is going to be there, and then I will wave my hands a bit and say how to renormalize it. So it is actually, yeah, so that was the main input of that framework, was to incorporate renormalization into that whole story of algebraic quantum field theory. Okay, so yeah, that's why, so we use a lot of techniques which are standard in mathematics, and well, people use them in other contexts as well. So we use some formal deformation quantization, we use homological algebra, and yeah, on the physics side, we use renormalization. I should mention some names because I'm not alone in that field. So, and this is just a few names. There's a lot of more, there's a lot of literature. So it kind of started with Brunetti, Deutsch, and Frenhagen. Then there were works of Hollands and Wald, and there are more recent works of Vance, Hawkins, Pinamonti, and myself, which kind of brought this more on a sound mathematical footing. And talking about that, so the book that Laurent already mentioned, this is a sort of summary of the state of the art of perturbative AQFT, written in a way that a mathematician can read, I hope. And yeah, so if you're interested, then please have a look, enjoy it. It's to be read. Okay, so that is enough of advertising. Let me just give you a bit of context for my whole research and the AQFT community. So, it started, as I said, with these ideas of Hug and Kassler, but then it spread a bit. So this is kind of my branch, so locally covariant QFT and perturbative AQFT. And these are various connections. So there is renormalization, quantum gravity, cosmology, quantum field theory. So this research area can be thought of as a sort of set of tools that we can apply in many other research areas, in many other branches of mathematics and physics. Recently, also algebraic quantum information theory is gaining some traction. So that's also a thing I'm interested in nowadays. So there is the entanglement entropy. There is foundations of quantum theory that can be studied using this framework. So this is still ongoing. And there is, of course, quantum statistical mechanics, which can be used to describe solid state physics. So this is like the whole bunch of things that are interconnected together, and I would be happy to discuss with you if you have questions. Yes, please.
So somewhere in this picture is topological field theory.
Somewhat maybe in model building, I think. Yeah, I think in model building, I spelled out CFT in 2D because I like them very much. But I could also draw it here. can definitely make relations. Okay, so let me just now move to the next part. So I will try to say something concrete about what I'm doing. So this is going to be a speed run through perturbative AQFT. And I deeply apologize if this is too quick, but I only have that much time. So let's get moving. Let me start with what I consider physical input. So if you guys want me to build a model of a physical theory you're interested in, I need some information from you about what am I doing. Okay, so first you have to tell me what's space-time. And if I'm building up this beautiful functor, I need to probably know this for all space-times of some class. Now, on each spacetime, I want to know what objects I'm going to study. So am I interested in scalar fields, vector fields, tensor fields, or whatever? And this is encoded in something I call configuration space. So this E of M is going to be the space of field configurations on spacetime M. And I will call it E of M, regardless of what theory I'm talking about. So here are some. So typically, this will be a space of smooth sections of some vector bundle. So if you want to fix some sort of mathematical idea behind it. And here are the examples, the running examples I want to consider. So there is the free scalar field or scalar field more generally. So these are just smooth functions. For Young-Mills theory, so if I just consider the trivial principal bundle, then these are one forms on my manifold valued in some compact Lie algebra. And for effective quantum gravity, which I also want to mention, especially in the context of non-locality, this is going to be metric perturbations, so these guys. Okay, so these are the main examples. And regardless of which example I'm talking about, I will always use the notation phi for field configurations and completely dismiss the fact that they're indices. Apologies for that, but I can take only as many indices at once. Okay, so this is sort of kinematical structure up to now. And then there is the dynamics where I use some sort of modification of the Lagrangian formalism, covariant modification. And okay, so if you I'm sure that you are familiar with Lagrangian formalism in classical mechanics, so you can easily connect to something that you know. Okay, so observables. And let's start with classical observables. What are these? So I have my field configuration, and I make an observation. I make a measurement of something about this field configuration, and I get a number. So a good mathematical description of that is to consider classical observables as some smooth functions on my space of configurations. So for now, this is all without imposing any dynamics. And in a sort of physics-y jargon, this is called off-shell. So I consider all my field configurations, and I consider functionals of all field configurations. Dynamics will come later. This is not getting lost. But this is the starting object. And as the talk goes, I will drop this index m. So all these constructions are factorial anyway. So I will just use the notation e and c infinity of e to mean configurations and observables. And then you have to, in your mind, remember that this can all be done on a fixed space time. Okay, so before locality, there is some related word, which is localization. This is not quite the same. So localization of functionals of these classical observables is governed by what they call the space-time support. So if we had linear functionals, if we had distributions, then you can talk about support, which is the distributional support. And here you have something which is a bit more general. And let me tell you just the basic idea so you can see the formula here. But what it says is that points which are in the support of my functionals are those such that if I perturb my field configuration around that point, then my functional knows it. Okay? So here is some initial configuration. Here is a perturbation supported around some point. And if the functional sees the difference, then x is in my support. It's a very intuitive notion of in which points of space-time my functional should be localized. Okay, and now the main message which I want to state already, and then you can try to remember it as the talk goes. So the main message is that this whole PAQFT business is a machinery to turn classical observables into quantum observables. And it's sort of, it's like you turn the crank. So you throw in the classical observables, you turn the crank, and then quantum observables come out. So it's a, yes?
Is it because you were thinking of this main message that you made the functional valued in the complexes and not in the reals?
Well, that's helpful. Yeah, if I had them valued in the reals, then that would be bad. So that's a kind of like the basic thing. I would go, I would take something smaller than this huge space as my space of observables. But this is the biggest space where my observables sit. And yes, some of the elements of that space, which I then label by physical quantities, I can then turn into quantum observables. So for example, you tell me stress energy tensor. So you know what's a stress energy tensor classically. So you write down the corresponding functional. So stress energy tensor at a point or at the neighborhood of some point. And then I tell you what quantum observable this corresponds to in my game.
Classically, it's real. So.
Okay, so there are various further assumptions, right? So you might want things which are self-adjoint, right? So then for the classical story, where the adjoint is just the complex conjugation, these are reals. So if you ask for self-adjoint, then you get reals, right? But here I'm going to go in a slightly more exotic territory where there are ghosts and things that are not so real. So as everybody knows, ghosts are not real, right? So I want to keep that C there for convenience. Okay, so I will tell you later what observables are of interest in various contexts, and how do I find out. Okay, so now coming back to locality, so before I say what's non-local, I want to make precise what's local. And here is a very cute way to characterize local. So you can define local functionals on your space of configurations by the following property. So if I take three configurations such that this one and this one have disjoint supports, and I add them and evaluate the functional, then it behaves almost linear. So this is a sort of property which we also called additivity, which is a kind of weaker version of linearity. So you can think of being local as not so far off from being linear. So the next best thing from being linear. If this was linear, then this property obviously holds. Okay, so that's very exotic, right? That's not what you're used to. Fortunately, I have proven with my colleagues that in the context of functionals of field configurations, the way we use it in physics, this actually amounts to saying that f is an integral of some function of the finite jet of your field configuration. And there is also some compactly supported condition so that the whole thing makes sense. But so all the functionals you know and you call local because they are, you know, functions of finitely many derivatives and so on, these can be actually also characterized by this property. This has advantage that it can be applied in a more general context, so far away from quantum field theory. It's just, it's an algebraic property as opposed to that which has more analytic flavor to that. Okay, and I will also break this locality a bit. So I will introduce a weaker notion of locality, which would be more advantageous for diffeomorphism invariant observables. So that's the final part of the talk, if I ever get there. But it's more important that you understand than I get to all the speculation at the end. Okay, so that was local. Now, another good class of things is regular. So this has something to do with Lee's question, how do we regularize things? So by regular, I will call things which, when we quantize, have good UV behavior. So that's the physical way of saying it. Mathematical way of saying it, we look at derivatives, and we require these derivatives at all points to be smooth. Okay. So in general, this is a distributional section of whatever vector bundle I want to describe my field configurations with, but I require this to be actually smooth, because smooth is great. Then you can do all sorts of things. Also, I will call it polynomial if there is some n such that derivatives higher than n vanish. But that's also intuitive, right? That's how polynomials work. And by f, I will denote the space of regular, polynomial, and compactly supported functionals. So everything I want, and it's all very good. Yes, Ivan?
Yeah, if you have a polynomial, local functional, will it be of the previous form, but with f as polynomial on the jet bundle? With the little f polynomial?
Well, by polynomial, I actually mean just that. So it could also depend on derivatives.
Yes.
Yeah. So let me give you an example, maybe. So this is a regular polynomial guy. So it's quadratic in fields. So it takes phi of x, phi of y, and smears it with a test function which is smooth. So this is smooth, guys, on m squared. Okay? Now, to contrast this, now take f which is smooth on m, and consider a more familiar guy, so f times phi squared. This is local, right? Depends only on the value of the field. And if you want to write it in this form, let's see what happens. So f of x is what it is. Now, if I want to have phi of x and phi of y in the way I had it here, then I have to kind of pull them to the diagonal. So I need the delta distribution here in order to write it in the same way. So this guy is clearly not regular because delta distribution is not a smooth function. And this is the main issue if it comes to renormalization. So the things we want to renormalize are like this, and the things that don't need renormalization and behave very well are like that. So you can think of this guy as a sort of UV regulation of that. And because my time is finite, and I want to give you the main ideas before I get into technicalities, I will focus on these regulated guys. So I will give you the overview of the whole structure for these regular polynomials, and then very briefly I will tell you how it generalizes to local guys and also some class of non-local functionals as well. Yeah, but this is like the main example you want to keep in mind, that well-behaving things have to be regular. Okay, so now dynamics. Not to come too much into the details, I want some sort of Lagrangian density. So here I will work with things which are called generalized Lagrangians. It's not very scary. It's the same as Lagrangians, but I introduce a little cutoff here. So in order to make this whole thing well defined as a functional on a non-compact manifold, I take a Lagrangian density of whatever theory I want to consider. I give it this little cutoff, and this gives me my generalized cutoff Lagrangian. So the first one is the free scalar field. We all know it and love it. The second one is the pure Young-Mills. The third one is the Einstein-Hilbert action. So these are again the main heroes of this talk. So scalar field theory, gauge theories, and gravity. Yes.
Yeah, this might be trivial, but like, why the choice of name Lagrangian instead of action? Why not call it generalized action?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So, because this you think in terms of Lagrangian density, action would be equivalence classes of such guys, modulo total derivative. So, now this maybe becomes clearer when I give you the formula for the derivative. So given this guy, I define its derivative ds by taking variation and evaluating this on a test section psi, and then I choose my cutoff function f such that it's one around that test section. So in a sense, this definition, so you see, the Lagrangian itself depended on f, however, it's all the Lagrange derivative doesn't. So the class of Lagrangians that would give the same all the Lagrange derivative would be called actions. So, because, right, I mean, this completely ignores things which are of the form, let's say, df times something. So everywhere where I have derivatives of this test function, that wouldn't contribute to the Euler-Lagrange derivative, so wouldn't contribute to the dynamics. Okay, and we can, you know, forget about this for the moment. What we actually want to study are these Euler-Lagrange derivatives. So So what is DS geometrically? Okay, so, well, actually it turns out, yes, please.
That little f,
yeah.
Is that there mainly to make S be finite, or is it to get rid of all boundary terms?
It's both. It's an adiabatic cutoff, actually. Yeah, it's an adiabatic cutoff. So it keeps things away from the boundary, and yeah, it makes sure that things are infrared finite. But then you have to, so this is like, classically you can remove the cutoff this way. In a quantum situation, it's a bit more complex, but in the end you want to take some sort of adiabatic limit where you remove this cutoff.
Do your manifolds have boundaries, or are they all?
These ones don't. I will talk about boundaries at the end. So these are assumed to be globally hyperbolic, no boundary. So, yeah. Okay, so what's DS geometrically? It's actually just a one form on the space of configuration. So this is not a confusing notation. It really is supposed to be something like D of a functional. If we were working in compact setting on compact manifold, this would be literally the Durham differential on E of a functional. We are not in the compact setting, so we have to go through this yoga, but okay, what we are arriving at is honest to goodness one form on the space of configurations. So now the space of solutions to the dynamical equations of motion, we know these are things for which the Euler-Lagrange derivative vanishes. So mathematically, this is a zero locus of this one form. So I did all that physics stretching, and now I isolated the object which actually has the physical information about the classical theory. It's this one form, and it's zero locus. So let me try to go on with this a bit. So that said something about equations of motion. What about symmetries? I'm going to use what's called BV framework, BV for Batalin-Wilkowiski. And here, equations of motion are important, but also the notion of symmetries of the action is important. And these are identified with vector fields on the space of configurations. So you can think of, so this is like a very stupid picture because it's two-dimensional picture of something which is infinite dimensional, but please ignore it for a moment. So here is my space of field configurations, and I consider vector fields which describe some directions in that space, and symmetries would be special directions in which the action is constant. Okay, but before I do that, again, I want to do something cheap, so I want to restrict my attention to regular polynomial, compactly supported, and everything else, because it's Christmas, vector fields. So it's making my life easier. So V is all the best vector fields I can ever have in this context. And by definition, they act on my very best functionals as derivations. This notation might be a bit cryptic, so I take the variations, so the functional derivative, and contract it with the value of the vector field at the point. If you have intuition about finite dimensional vector fields, this is not too far off. Okay, so as I said, a symmetry of my given action, so equivalent class of Lagrangians, is a direction in the configuration space in which the action is constant. So if I take this directional derivative, so if I evaluate my one form, if I insert this one form to that vector field, then I get zero, identically zero. That's the symmetry. And there is a bit of notation which I want to sneak in already at this stage. So I denote by delta S the map which takes vector field and spits out the vector field inserted to the one form. And this has a good reason for being there. Okay, that was a bit of an abstract story. Now let's try to look at this in a very concrete example. So the first concrete example which I want to talk about is the free scalar field. And the first thing I want to do with it, I want to consider its classical theory. So this DS, which might have been very mysterious up to now, in this case is when you evaluate it at phi, this is the Klein-Gordon operator applied to phi. So this is a very concrete thing. And you can consider the space of solutions of this equation, of Klein-Gordon equation, as a subspace of all field configurations. And what I'm interested in the end is the space of functionals on these solutions. So this would be my on-shell observables, so actual observables, functions of the solutions. Okay, so how do I do that? I will do some homological magic. So first I consider functions that vanish on solutions. So I denote it by F0, and I assume, which can actually be checked in this case, they are all in the image of my map delta S. So they all look like the Euler-Lagrange derivative, one form inserted to a vector field from my beautiful class of vector fields. Okay, so what are my on-shell observables? These are all the observables modulo these irrelevant ones which vanish on the space of solutions. So I mod out these superfluous functions. So I get a quotient. Now, the nice thing you can do with a quotient is to resolve a quotient. So before I do that, I want to also check. So I know that F0 is in the image of delta S. Now, for a sneaky reason, I want to do some homology. I want to also know what's the kernel of delta S. And by definition, what's the kernel of delta S? So these are the vector fields. If I insert the Euler-Lagrange derivative, I get zero. So symmetries are exactly what's in the kernel of delta S. It's a very small differential. But OK, so here, that's a baby version of what I want to do. So I have my functions. I have the map from vector fields to functions. So this is delta S. Its image is these superfluous guys I want to quotient out. Its kernel is going to be symmetries. And now I can assume that there are no non-trivial symmetries. So this is the case for the free scalar field. And then I can extend this baby example into something larger, which is called the BV complex. So that's actually, that's where the homological algebra is coming into the game. So I build this huge thing. So this is exterior algebra over vector fields. So this is polyvector fields. The differential is the smart little differential that knows everything about equations of motion and symmetries, at least in this context. And the space of classical on-shell observables, so the guys I'm interested in, is the zero cohomology. Oops, sorry, that should be up, not down. Zero cohomology of that complex. Let me pause for a moment, because this is going to be like a running example, running idea I want to talk about. So I have the space I want. Okay, so these are the on-shell classical observables. I characterize them as a cohomology of something. So here I have some differential graded algebra. And now, so that's the classical story. Now the quantum story is going to be about deformation of this object. So I needed this object, I need this differential graded algebra in order to run my quantization procedure. So instead of working with quotients, I work with something which is larger, but then simpler to handle, especially simpler to deform. Okay, so there is, yes, yes.
Can you just, again, repeat the definition of E of V and lambda?
Which one?
What is the BV?
The BV is, so lambda V is the exterior algebra, so all the anti-symmetric powers of V. So lambda V is polyvector fields, and BV is the pair. So polyvector. Yeah, polyvector. Yeah,
because P-O-L-Y.
Yes.
Well, I thought
yeah.
It was P-A-U-L-I. I couldn't.
Oh, no, no, no. not poly. Poly. Yeah, no, this is, yeah. So or multi-vector fields. Yeah, that's better. You don't confuse it with names of physicists this way. Yeah, so BV is multi-vector fields equipped with this differential. And this differential is insertion of one form. So geometrically, this differential has like a nice natural interpretation. So you have multi-vector fields and you have insertion of a one form which reduces the degree. Yes?
Is the CVG assumed to be continuous here?
Which one is assumed, sorry?
CVG.
The symmetry, are they assumed to be continuous? Well, they are assumed to be smooth.
Infinitesimal, right?
Sorry?
Infinitesimal.
Oh, infinitesimal symmetries. Okay.
They're vector fields.
Yeah, they're vector fields. So in a sense, okay, so you think of your symmetry group as a Lie group, infinite dimensional Lie group, and then you think about its Lie algebra, and elements of this Lie algebra can be identified with some vector fields. So
I consider discrete symmetries.
Sorry, I don't hear.
Discrete
symmetries. Oh, discrete symmetries are not in this class. So this is only for, this is something which characterizes local gauge symmetries. So like in Young-Mills theory or diffeomorphism symmetry in gravity. So this is the scope of that framework. Yes?
Is the fact that the higher cohomology groups vanish, is that just true by construction for this differential? Like, you can just show that it'll happen?
It's true for the scalar field because there are no non-trivial symmetries. If you take Young-Mills theory instead, then that won't be true. But then what people do, they add things in higher degree to kill that cohomology. So in physics, you typically want to construct a sequence. You want to construct this DG algebra in such a way that here the higher cohomologies vanish. But this is a bit of a matter of what you want to do. So you can also take the stance that, okay, it is what it is. I want to compute the cohomologies, whatever they are. Right, it's just that in physics, typically, you want them dead, so you kill them. That's very violent. But in free scalar, actually in scalar field, as such, real scalar field, there are no symmetries to worry about. Okay, so let me maybe skip some of the story. Just a very short remark. There is the Poisson algebra structure on this space of multivector fields, zero shifted. I mean, I know that there is one shifted bracket, but in this case, there is also a zero shifted. So honest to goodness, Poisson bracket, which you obtain by the construction of pious. So some of you might be familiar with it. So what I call a DG, so differential graded classical field theory model for a given spacetime, is this BV complex equipped with a structure of a pious bracket. And if I want to go on shell, then I take the zero cohomology, not homology, of that context, of that complex. Okay, and this is the guy which on the next slide I'm going to very quickly deform. Okay, so I want to perform deformation quantization of that Poisson algebra I had on the previous slide. So I introduce a star product, and again, this formula might be familiar to you if you're at all familiar with deformation quantization. So this is the Moyal product. Here I take the same kernel as I used for defining the Peyer's bracket, and this is totally anti-symmetric. I have a freedom of choosing a symmetric path, which in the more physical language means that I have a freedom to choose normal ordering. So we all know that there is the question of ordering in quantization. In deformation quantization, this is encoded in the choice of this deformation kernel. Yeah, and the only, so okay, there are many requirements, but for now, let me just stress that this kernel here has to be of positive type. So it's something which in the end becomes two-point function in your theory. So, okay, so usually you know what to do in this situation. Okay, so this is my non-commutative product. I get my non-commutative algebra, non-commutative space, and this was all for free theory. So the model is then given by this BV complex. I consider formal power series in H bar, because you see this H bar enters here as a formal parameter. I have my beautiful star product, and I have complex conjugation as the star operation. And I'm happy. I have free theory. This is great. But this is not all I want from life. I want to also have interaction. So let me just tell you how I do that. So for the interaction, I introduce another operation. So there is something which is called time ordering operator. Again, it's a kind of exponential type formula where I conveniently lost 1 over n factorial. Very sorry about that. It should be an exponential, so 1 over n factorial should be there. The same factor should be there. And delta f is now the Feynman propagator of the theory. Okay, and now there is just a connection to what you might know from more traditional quantum field theory. So applying this time ordering operator is the same morally as taking the convolution with the Gaussian measure, where the covariance is given by this Feynman propagator. So in a sense, now I want to do Feynman. So I want to do a path integral, but I want to do it carefully, and I want to do it in an algebraic manner so that things are still rigorous and well-defined. But I mean, this sort of correspondence is actually true in the finite dimensional setting. Okay, so now I use this time ordering to define the time ordered product. And now in one slide, I can tell you what my interacting theory is, which is, I think, quite nice. So I have the time ordering operator, time ordered product. I use this to define the formal S matrix for a given choice of interaction. And I use these formal S matrices to define what I'm in the end interested in is the interacting field, so the interacting observables. So these are again defined in terms of the time ordered exponentials and the star product. So, okay, so you give me two things here. So you give me the interaction, and you give me some observable that you're interested in, like stress energy tensor, for example. Only it has to be regularized if I want to use this formula. And I tell you, okay, so this RV of F is the observable, the full interacting quantum observable corresponding to that. And this is all at the completely algebraic level. No Hilbert spaces were harmed using this construction. Okay, and finally, to wrap things up, I can use this map for a further deformation of my star product, and I define the interacting star product here. So, yeah, so this is the slide of interacting field theory. These are all the things I have to do in order to construct the interacting field theory. And if I'm in a less fortunate situation where I don't have a regular functional to work with, then this takes a while, but it's a fairly well understood systematic procedure. Okay, two things to mention. We have some results on convergence. So we have a nice formula with Eli Hawkins for the interacting star products, where you get only finite sum at each order in H bar. So there is some hope for the future. And we also have a convergent, you can say non-perturbative formula for the S matrix in the Sine-Gordon model. So there are situations where you can do better than just formal power series. You can actually show that things converge. So this is hope for the future. Good. I'm running out of time. I'm going to maybe skip the most technical part of it. So apologies for everybody who is interested in technical part of it. There is a recent paper of myself and Owen William, who is in the audience, so you can bother him about it, where we compare this point of view, which I just presented, with the point of view of Kevin and Owen, where you think about quantum field theory in terms of factorization algebras. I might go into the detail if you ask me the right questions at the end, but let me just go to the punchline. I'm sorry for doing this. I will skip this. So the punchline here is that in perturbative AQFT, the way we construct the quantum theory is by deforming the product. So there was this star product and the interacting star product, whereas in Costello-William approach, what one deforms is the differential. So there was this little differential delta S. So that was the classical BV differential. What they do, they construct the quantum BV differential. And what we have shown with Owen is that both viewpoints can actually be shown to be equivalent, at least in the context where they both apply. So one has to make certain restrictions. But morally speaking, these two deformations are actually related using the map T, so the time ordering operator in the free case, and the map RV, so the map which defines interacting fields, interacting functionals, the interacting case. So these are very explicit, and you can actually, you know, do the math and find that you actually get the same structures. If you're interested in this, I can tell you more about it later. What we did with Owen was neglecting functional analytic renormalization issues. So now we have to rectify it. So at the moment, we are working on a paper where we also include renormalization in the game. So this uses the so-called Epstein-Glaser framework. And then all this comparison, we are very confident, should be also done in that case. Okay. So finally, I came to the more interesting part of the talk, so I wanted to say something about non-locality. So first of all, I spend a lot of time on the free scalar field and interacting scalar field. Apologize for that. But to do gauge theories is actually not that more complicated in this framework. So what you do, you replace your space of configurations with a graded space where you have the configurations in 0 degree, and in degree one you have ghosts. So these ghosts are nothing else but degree one elements of the Lie algebra of your theory. So you can run this whole machinery now on graded spaces, and then you realize that this is not that much difficult. And then you get Gish Eurispo free. Okay, well, literature, you can probably find it easily online. So there is the main paper with Renhagen I had on the BV formalism. And then we applied it to two things, quantum gravity and cosmological perturbation theory, which is where the non-locality comes into. And let me go into that. So first of all, okay, I don't think I'm saying anything controversial by stating that locality has to be given up if you want diffeomorphisms, invariant observables for the purpose of quantum gravity. Now, what I want to advocate is that in this framework, which I'm considering, these can be easily constructed, at least perturbatively, starting from classical things. So let me give you a flavor of classical things that I want to then throw into that machinery and get out quantum interacting diff invariant observables. Okay, so first of all, I'm giving up locality. Okay, locality has gone, but I don't want to give it up too much because it's useful. So I want to look at things which are non-local in a very controlled way. So here is one construction. I use something which corresponds to relational observables. So first of all, I take four scalars, and these four scalars should work as something like configuration-dependent coordinate system. So I'm in a generic situation, so not too many symmetries. So I can construct four scalars depending on the metric. And now if I pull back the metric by a diffeo, then this is how these scalars transform. That's well known. And one can think of the choice of these four fields in a sense as a choice of observer. So I've heard Laurent talking about something related before, but you can also, you know, just go on with mathematics. And then I do perturbation theory, so I fix the background in such a way that this map from a point of space-time to the values of these four scalars is injective, so that they define a good coordinate system in some neighborhood. Okay, and then I don't want to go too far from that nice point, so I consider a patch of my space of metrics where these just small perturbations from there. And I take the following. So I have these four scalars at G0 and compose it with the inverse of the corresponding map for the full G. I call it alpha G. So the good thing about that object is that it transforms under diffeos by left action instead of right action. So you have, so you have pullback by the diffeo, and here you have the diffeo to minus one acting from the left. This is super convenient because now I can use this to cancel out the effect of a diffeo acting on any other scalar. So I can consider a quantity where I have some other scalar composed with that map alpha. This is super non-local, but is invariant under diffeos. When I said super non-local, okay, why is it so? Well, physically what it means, and why I call it relational observables, that I want to evaluate AG at a point where these four scalars xg take a given value. So it's a sort of, you know, relational or also called partial observables. And similar ideas have been developed in loop quantum gravity. So there are works of Bianca here and also works of Rovelli and Timan on related subjects. Yes, Kevin?
I just understand, should I think of these xgs
So it's a bit more than that. So they are functions of some dynamical variables, right? So let's say, so one of them could be a Ricci scalar or Weyl scalar, right? So they depend on, yeah, they depend on the metric, or they could depend on scalar fields that are in the theory. Yeah. Okay, so in a sense, you know, this concept has been used in other approaches as well. And then by considering these objects, I can build functionals which depend on two choices of data. So one is this observable A, and the other is something like a choice of observer. So the choice of these four scalar fields X. And they both transform under diffeos, but the whole combination doesn't. Okay. And clearly this is non-local, but the good thing about it from the technical viewpoint is that this FA here, although it is non-local, it has local derivatives. So if I take functional derivatives of that with respect to the fields of the theory, I get local quantities at each point. So although this is, of course, non-local, for the sake of doing Epstein-Glaser and renormalization in my setting, this is as good as local. So I'm free to include these non-local observables without any extra cost. So this was essentially what we did with this paper on perturbative quantum gravity. Okay, I see that I'm running out of time, so I should probably cut down the speculations. There is one more way I can envisage, also including non-locality into the story, is to extend this BV formalism into BFV formalism. So there is a version of BV formalism which is made especially for theories with boundary. So this is called BFV for Batalin, Fratkin, Wilkowiski. What I would like to do would be to understand how this fits into my general setting. There has been work done along these lines already, although not published. So if you're interested in discussion, I'm happy to comply. So let me maybe just go to the general overview. Okay. So yeah, so having some sort of a full picture where we have the usual BV theory in the bulk along the lines I presented you, coupled to something on the boundary, coupled to something in the corners, and so on. So that's what I'm currently working on with Michele Schiavina and Alberto Cattaneo in Zurich. So hopefully that works out. Other things which one can do in this framework. I mentioned some convergence results with Dorothea Banz. But in fact, we are studying some more integrable models. So we did something for Sine Gordon, but there is, of course, more to be done, and trying in particular to see how dualities work in the PAQFT framework, and how especially dualities between local and non-local degrees of freedom. So this is what we have already seen for Sine Gordon to Turing, but there's definitely scope for more. Along the similar lines, there are also conformal field theories. And this is now ongoing work with Benoit Vicedo and Samuel Crawford, who were here before Christmas. So we are working on trying to understand how to merge more algebraic methods used in CFTs with the PAQFT viewpoint. And again, things like dualities and non-locality are a point of focus. There was the interacting star product. The way we obtain it is a sort of formal deformation quantization. It would be nice to understand it also from the geometric quantization viewpoint, which I find really nice, and apply this to discrete space-time models, so for example, causal sets. And this is ongoing work with Eli Hawkins and my student, Christoph Mintz. Hopefully something will come out of this soon. And okay, this is in the realm of far speculation. We have some convergence result for theories in 2D. We want to be able to extract more information out of our asymptotic series. So we want to use things like Borel summability and resurgence and to kind of do what people call go beyond perturbation theory to push the limits of what you can do with a perturbation series. And this is a project with Pierre Clavier. He was also here in November at the Eminuta conference. Okay, I'm happy to discuss any of these and even more, but I think my time is up for this colloquium, so thank you.
Any questions by the students?
So talking on my nominees, my best nominees approach.
That's a good question. Okay, maybe I have a slide for that. It's in one of the things I skipped. Apologies for that. In our framework, we have this classical BV differential, and we construct the formal S matrix for a given interaction. And there is a very important condition for the renormalization of our theory, is that this S matrix is invariant under this classical BV differential. So this condition can be translated into the so-called quantum master equation. And if this quantum master equation cannot be fulfilled, then we say that there are anomalies. So, and this quantum master equation is a crucial condition for the BV operator, for the quantum BV operator to be a local operator. So, anomalies, I would say, are either in. Yeah, so it's essentially the breaking of the quantum master equation.
So if it's not satisfied, say there's some Tokutta anomaly, can you also use this approach to find a high dimensional bulk to cancel the anomaly?
You can. Okay, so what you can do in principle is so if you have the theory with boundary, you can use boundary terms or boundary theory to try to cancel off the anomaly, because then instead of this operator, you have an operator which also has a boundary contribution. So this is what you do in BFV formalism. So yeah, this is a possibility. But I mean, it has to be checked on a theory to theory basis.
How does the there are two interrelated questions. So, how do states appear, and how can we compute the expectation values using cohomology, computer cohomology observations?
Okay, so the states are normalized positive functionals on the algebra of observables. So, of course, I didn't say anything about states. I told you how to construct the algebra. And then the next question is, what are the possible states on that algebra? There is a very natural class of states. So all your elements of this big algebra, they are functionals, right? So if I have an F here, an obvious state would be evaluation of that functional at a given configuration. So, for example, taking the evaluation at zero is one possible state of the theory, which then, in a sense, corresponds to taking vacuum expectation values with respect to the vacuum you chose for the star product. So, yeah, so there are states. Some of them come from the classical theory as evaluation functionals, but there are more states. But this is, I didn't understand the second part of your question. I mean, you use the, yeah, you use the cohomology to get at gauge invariant on-shell observables. I'm not sure what you meant by using the cohomology to compute
in
states.
In here, we use the, we have a chain complex that was on lambda v, but if we had that, what appears in five-dimensional is that the chain complex, the extended chain complex on the cotangent shifted bundle computes.
Yeah, I mean, in finite dimension, you're in a better situation. But I mean, here you have all of these objects are still dependent on the field configuration. So these are not numbers. These are functions of field configurations. So in order to specify a state, you have to fit in a field configuration. So the cohomology as such doesn't really give you a number, okay? But of course, when you evaluate it at a given field configuration, then you get numbers. So maybe that's, but yeah, there's a bit more structure than in the finite dimensional, I think.
Question from the general?
So is this, can this be made Lorentzian, or is it
Lorentzian? This is Lorentzian. All of this is Lorentzian, yes.
But then the regularization looks like it's hard, I mean, it's of course well known, it's hard to make it Lorentz invariant.
Yeah, so
as a Euro, so
yeah, so this
function.
Yeah, so the thing is that you don't do traditional regularization. You just say that, okay, so let me go back to the relevant slide. So yeah, it's within this Epstein-Glaser framework. So what you do is that you say, okay, so I know these time-ordered products for regular functionals, and now I want to compute them for local functionals. But this amounts to extension of certain distributions. So this is all done Lorentz invariant because there is no cutoff. There is no explicit cutoff. I just say that I know the coefficients here of this product for regular things and things with disjoint supports. And then I want to extend it as a distribution on a Lorentzian manifold. So you can impose Lorentz invariants for these distributions explicitly as one of randomization conditions. So it doesn't, yeah. So there is no explicit cutoff.
So there's no explicit regularization?
No. It's more like you know something for regular things, and then you want to find out what this is for non-regular.
So
but
what's the principle that lets you?
It's the causality.
How unique?
Yeah, it's very very good question. So the non-uniqueness is governed by randomization group. So the reason why you can do it is because you have the causal factorization property. So you have causality imposed in your theory, and then. Yeah, non-uniqueness. Okay, so if the theory is renormalizable, then this non-uniqueness is governed by adding finitely many counter terms. So yeah, so you have this huge renormalization group, and orbits of this renormalization group can be finite dimensional for renormalizable theories. So. This is all actually very old. I mean, this is due to Epstein-Glaser from the 70s. So they kind of developed this approach of randomization without regularization, so to say, that you impose a set of axioms for these time-ordered products, and then you show that there exist time-ordered products fulfilling these axioms by recursive procedure. And yeah, it's very, very Lorentzian, actually. It's something which has more, place in the Lorentzian signature than Euclidean.
These semi Feynman diagrams are mannequins with boundary.
Yeah.
It's like a giant pain. Like boundaries give you all these extra boundary counter terms, and like, does the Epstein laser approach work well on mannequins with boundary?
Well, we don't do Feynman diagrams.
Okay. Well, you said you didn't regularize, but it's kind of like a point scaling regularization.
It's sort of, yeah, but yeah.
Does that work on that? I mean,
well, so
things I like are very difficult in manifolds of boundary. Does this
Let me see. So there are some works with on manifolds with boundary, but it's typically also more pain. So what I think works better is this BFV construction, but then the theory on the boundary is just geometrically quantized. So yeah. So I guess with appropriate choice of boundary conditions, then yes, but I mean, okay, so let's see. Is it the main technical ingredient is the propagation of singularities, and this is super well understood in globally hyperbolic spacetimes without boundary. So it is a bit more of a pain because things can reflect off the boundary and you get a mess. So I expect that this is also a mess, but this is also not very well studied, so maybe.
So regarding the uniqueness of the regularization, said that a classical spacetime is the causal structure that gives you unique regularization.
Yeah. So okay. This is all kind of done in the spirit of QFT on curved spacetime. So you fix a background, and then this gives you the causal structure, and then you construct your theory on top of it. So perturbatively, the causal structure is fixed by the background. Non-perturbatively, I don't know. I hope there is something better than that. But at the moment, it's understood with respect to the background causal structure.
When you do perturbative quantum gravity, I guess there's a question whether you still have a unique regularization.
It's perturbative. It's perturbative. It's sort of like effective theory on the background, right? So it's really very silly. But I think, okay, so there are things that effective theory can and cannot do. And I would only, you know, recommend to maybe think about it to understand how observables behave and what classes of diff invariant observables you might want to consider. So I think it's a good testing ground for various concepts of observables, because there is a nice way from classical to quantum observables. But this is not a theory of everything. And for things like, you know, changing causal structure, I don't think this is the best ground, unless we understand how to extract non-perturbative information out of that, which, you know, may happen, but it's not there yet.
Okay, one last question.
Ian, when you ran out of time, you said something about using a second method to get non-local observables on the boundary. Can you say a little bit more?
Okay, sure. So this is kind of inspired by my background in infrared problems in QED. So this is more like a speculation at this point. So in this BFV formalism, in the first instance, you can consider theories with finite boundaries, but also you can take some sort of a limit of a finite boundary to infinity and have, sort of boundary at infinity. So you can consider observables associated to infinity. So this is an idea of my former Master thesis advisor, Andre Herdegen, who had this idea of how to solve infrared problems in QED using non-local observables. And so he proposed a way to, you know, go beyond the AQFT framework and allow for non-locality in QED in order to cure the infrared problem. And the main idea was that well, he considered this asymptotic algebra of, well, fermions and radiation. And then he postulated that this asymptotic degrees of freedom that live at infinity should also be quantized and should be treated on the same footing as the bulk observables. Yeah, so I think it's a cool idea. And I have a project with Michele Schiavina where we try to realize this using the BFV formalism. And okay, so the non-locality here is that you have the coupling between these observables at infinity and observables in the bulk. So QED would be the first testing ground for that. And another way maybe of thinking of these, and again, this is a pure speculation, you can think of such observables as a kind of dressed observables. So you can think, for example, about the electron together with its field of infrared photons. And then it's clearly non-local, right? Because it goes all the way to infinity.
Does it mean that the observables would be local on the boundary, but not...
Yeah. They would be local at the...
Like it happens in ADS...
Yeah, they would be local at the boundary, but yeah, so that's the idea, right? So you have things local in the bulk, local at the boundary, and you have some coupling between them. But this is certainly an extension of, you know, the AQFT conservative approach where everything is local in the bulk and that's all there is.
I mean, there must be some way of getting the diffeomorphism, the bulk diffeomorphism invariance. So there must be some way of tying the boundary to the bulk.
Yeah.
Is there some geometrical explanation?
Yeah. So practically speaking, you do it by means of this BV differential. So BV differential has a term which lives on the boundary. It's kind of like this way of thinking of, you think, everything in terms of the differential, right? So the differential kind of knows both about the bulk and knows about the boundary. And then it changes what does it mean to be diff invariant as well, because it takes into account this boundary component. But yeah, I mean, this is still work in progress, but we are kind of optimistic about it.
Okay.